Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When then Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder and four of his associates were arrested in July for their alleged roles in a $61 million bribery and racketeering scheme, Chris Hoffman, the FBI special agent in charge of the Cincinnati field office, made it clear that they don't take such malfeasance lightly.
Our number one priority in the FBI is public corruption. That's because public corruption erodes public confidence and undermines the strength of our great democracy.
And corruption, secret deals, and dark money are nothing new. We're talking today about efforts in Ohio and across the country to, return transparency to state legislatures. Robert McGuire is the research director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. It's a nonpartisan government ethics and transparency watchdog group in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Aristotle Huttress is the former longtime executive director of the Ohio Retirement Study Council and former chief executive of the Ohio House of Representatives. And he's also been consulting with Common Cause on a proposal to change what we're talking about today. Aristotle Huttress, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann.
And Catherine Terser, Executive Director of Common Cause Ohio and Coordinator of the Fair Districts Equal Fair Elections Coalition. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Hello, everybody. Thank you.
Hey, Catherine, I said you're working to return transparency to the Ohio General Assembly on purpose. There used to be more access to the inner workings of the process, you know, how the sausage is made, right? What changed and why?
So, you know, it's not the most surprising story, and yet it also is. So in the late 90s, there was an Ohio senator named Roy Ray, and he was a senator at the same time as he was a lobbyist for Ohio Edison. So if you think Ohio Edison, everybody should think First Energy. And so we're talking about more than 20 years ago, there was this scandal that we know about simply because we had access to the records that the Legislative Service Commission creates. Now that's, you know, an agency that writes bills, does research.
It's totally in the weeds, right? Yeah.
And what happened is, as opposed to creating greater transparency, for example, you know, ethics transparency or financial disclosure transparency, what happened instead was they closed down the records so that we can't actually see how the sausage is made.
And
we don't have access to those records.
Well, how did they justify it at the time?
Well, that's one of those things that I think is incredibly difficult. You know, one of the things that we do know is that folks who have pushed back on our call for greater transparency will say, oh, well, we have some bad ideas and we don't really, you know, want everybody to see, you know, that process. But, you know, when push comes to shove, it's okay to have bad ideas. What's important is that we understand how we work through those ideas to create good legislation. And I often think the folks that are worried about transparency are worried about the fact that special interests are writing their bills.
You know, Aris, one of the things in reviewing the Roy Ray story, you know, back then I was covering this. Well, I think that was just right after I stopped covering the Ohio General Assembly. But in any event, I remember Roy Ray. The fact is, he wasn't breaking any laws by doing that either, right?
That's correct.
Yep. And it's still legal to do what he was doing, Catherine?
So one of the things that is clear is that it is not legal at this point to actually do this type of lobbying.
Okay.
It's just that, unfortunately, they've created a situation where we couldn't actually figure out if they were doing it.
Right.
So even though they're not supposed to do it, we can't actually figure it out.
Aris, did you want to say something?
Yeah, it's no one is suggesting that lobbyists or industry can help write legislation. I mean, what our concern is, I mean, I think the general public, is that we should just know who has input on public policy. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't read a quote from Plato. Now, this is like 2,500 years old.
Okay.
So this subject we're dealing with has been around for centuries. Plato said, we can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. Now that's millennium. I mean, people have always wanted transparency in their government. And I mean, I don't know how many of you attended the virtual David Brooks presentation, Capital Square Foundation, mm-hmm. that I'm a proud member of. But his whole speech was about patriotism, what it means to be an American, nationalism. And one of the big things he said that stuck with me is there are good people in a rotten system. So the system needs fixed. And I mean, as Ann knows, and well, Catherine too, I've been around a long time. Now, everybody wants to co-sponsor a bill. Everybody wants part of a good idea. So it makes no sense to me. And when this happened in 1999, I mean, personally, I think the legislature overreacted. You know, it's kind of like it's public policy. So why wouldn't the public be involved in public policy?
I read a piece by Minnesota, I think it's Minnesota Public Media, about what happened in 1999 in the Ohio General Assembly, which I think is really kind of interesting. And at the then President Richard Finan, Senate President Richard Finan, and Roy Ray, Senator Roy Ray at the time, both defended the secrecy by saying if you have to reveal everything, then all of the really talented, super experienced experts on issues and blah, blah, blah are not going to be attracted to the Ohio General Assembly because it's too much. It's a hassle and it's too much revelation. Robert McGuire, I'm wondering how Ohio stacks up compared to the rest of the country on this score. Is this a trend that's gone across the country, making things more secret?
Well, what I can say, particularly about the householder incident, is that it did not happen in a vacuum. That the context in which it happened was that, you know, in North Carolina, for example, just last year, there was a billionaire who was caught on tape explaining how he would use dark money groups to bribe officials to get rid of a regulator that oversaw his industries. We've seen various instances around the country where, for example, in Nevada, a longtime lobbyist for the payday lending industry was caught in emails explaining how representatives of the payday lending industry could funnel money through dark money groups so that he could get elected without people knowing that he had their support. And he was sort of explicitly saying, you know, you'll have a guy in the attorney general's office. And so one thing that we see time and time again with dark money groups, with the lack of transparency, is that it works in the favor of wealthy industries, wealthy individuals who are able to craft legislatures, not legislators, but craft, you know, sort of the makeup of who is holding office in certain states and at the federal level. And then also use these same vehicles to shape policy, either through grassroots lobbying, AstroTurf, but also through writing model legislation that sometimes is just outright adopted by its state representatives and put in bills that then pass.
And we've talked about that before, like ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, a very conservative group that creates model legislation that we see being cloned all over this country.
Right. And so what I have learned from almost 10 years of tracking dark money is essentially if you have enough money to be spending millions of dollars in politics, you have enough money to hire the best lawyers and accountants in the country to cover your tracks. And the householder incident, the other incidents that I mentioned are notable just because they slipped up and we caught them. Mm. There is no doubt in my mind that this is something that is happening across the country every year. And it works in the favor of people who have the money to be you know, and resources to be creating these kinds of pushes.
What is the role, just to refresh all of our memories and the listeners' memories, Robert, of Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision? You said you've been following this for 10 years. That's since Citizens United was ruled on by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right. Citizens United really, it was a decision that really freed up corporations to spend heavily in our elections. What it did for dark money, though, is it's sort of seen as this watershed moment, but it was actually a part of a process that had already begun. There was a case called Wisconsin Right to Life v. FEC in 2007 that opened the doors for these groups to start spending on what are called electioneering communications. It's one of these campaign finance terms, but basically issue ads that are run close to an election. So they're not saying vote for, vote against, but they're saying so-and-so is terrible. So call them and tell them that you don't like them. We right after that decision, at the federal level, we saw spending by dark money groups go from in the $5 to $10 million range in elections to tens of millions of dollars. And then Citizens United further sort of released the shackles off of these groups, and we saw spending go into the hundreds of millions of dollars in elections. And in the 10 years since, there has been essentially no regulations or reform that has accounted for the changes that we've seen since Citizens United.
Now, in 2010, then State Senator John Husted, now our lieutenant governor, sponsored a bill that would have strengthened campaign finance disclosure rules for corporations, nonprofits, and labor organizations. Eris, can you address what happened to that bill, or Catherine Terser? Catherine?
I just jump in. Yep. What is amazing is 10 years ago, we did in fact have an opportunity to require better disclosure following Citizens United. Mm-hmm. Citizens United basically said that corporations had the right to do political advertisements. But the U.S. Supreme Court at the same time said, hey, disclosure is a good. It's good for the stockholders. It's good for the public. It's good for accountability. And it really made sense for Ohio to do the right thing. So at that point, you know, John Husted was an Ohio senator. He's now lieutenant governor, but he had his eye on being Secretary of State. And he had a bill that required good disclosure, and it passed out of the Ohio Senate. Now, this is the challenge. The Senate at that point was a Republican chamber. And the Senate was a Republican chamber, and the House was a Democratic one. And they didn't want to give, you know, props to a guy who was running for Secretary of State. And so what happened is we lost our ability for 10, you know, like for a really long time to get good disclosure. And, you know, this, we're at a point where we could pay a lot of attention to all the details of House Bill 6. And we, you know, the recent information about AEP and their engagement with their nonprofit that then gave to Generation Now. And all of those details are really important and interesting. But we should look at this as an opportunity to do some real significant reform. And that includes the kind of transparency that we were talking about, where a better disclosure at the State House and then related to our elections. And, you know, Aristotle, I wanted to highlight, he was the one who suggested that we call the bill that we're proposing, our idea, the Jim Siegel bill. And Jim was a wonderful reporter at the Columbus Dispatch and an advocate for open government. And he is the kind of champion that we want this bill to be associated with. Ari, do you want to explain?
Yeah, the late Jim Siegel, the late great Jim Siegel. Go ahead, Aristotle. Yeah.
Before I do that, I want to echo what Catherine's explanation of that. And I think the biggest problem we have in politics now, and when I started in politics, $25,000, that's all it took to run an Ohio House race, okay? Now, the parties, they I don't know why they're so reluctant to do the right thing, because Catherine gave you the lay of the land. The Republicans had control of the Senate. The Democrats had control of the House. So obviously, folks on the Democrat-controlled House figured, hey, you know, this big money's a good thing, you know, for winning elections. But it's a bad thing for the system. So, I mean, the folks just have to get together and say, what is right for democracy, not what is right for the party.
You know, a similar thing happened with redistricting, right, Catherine? They were getting ready to pass, I think it was John Husted again was Speaker of the House at that point, and they were moving something through, but the Democrats, who thought they had a shot at controlling the drawing the lines, they put the kibosh on it.
Yes.
Yeah, that was actually really heartbreaking.
Yes, it was.
So usually you have the power that's, you know, the people that are the party that's in control that don't want to change the rules because, you know, they really are benefiting from being able to draw these district lines that benefit them.
Yes.
And the party out of power that is like, hey, we need good reform. Well, what happened in 2009, once again, you know, you have the Senate that was Republican and the House that was Democrat. The House thought, hey, we're gonna actually be able to run the table. And so the weird thing is that the Ohio Senate ended up passing a redistricting reform measure, and the Ohio House passed a redistricting reform measure, but they weren't the same measures.
That's right.
With this, you know, a map making process that created a district that literally goes from Toledo to Cleveland.
Yes.
So, you know, one of the things that I think is really important here is we think about, well, what are the kinds of things that we can do to improve democracy? We need to really focus on voters. We need to really be thinking about, like, how can we indict the process so they better understand things.
We got to take a break right now, but I just want to end this segment with saying that one other thing that Dick Finan and I think Roy Roy said at the time in 1999 was the people don't care about this. It's just reporters and government watchdog groups like Common Cause. So with that, I will take a quick break. Our guests are Catherine Turser, Executive Director of Common Cause Ohio, Aristotle Hutteris, former longtime Executive Director of the Ohio Retirement Study Council, former Chief Executive of the Ohio House of Representatives. He's been around a while, and he is consulting with Catherine on this proposal to change our access to information when it comes to how laws are made. Also with us, Robert McGuire. He's Research Director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, a nonpartisan Government Ethics and Transparency Watchdog Group. We'll be right back. We're talking about transparency in how laws are made right today. So if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The House Bill 6 nuclear bailout scandal has renewed efforts to promote ethics and transparency in government in Ohio, but it's not just Ohio. D.C. watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington last week declared, quote, our democracy is broken, end quote, and laid out a roadmap for how to fix it. Still with us, Catherine Turser, Executive Director of Common Cause Ohio, Aristotle Hutteris, former longtime Executive Director of the Ohio Retirement Study Council, former Chief CEO of the House of Representatives, and who's consulting with Catherine Turser on this on their proposals, and Robert McGuire, Research Director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Robert, Crew laid out 8 ways in which American democracy needs to reform. But first, I want you to talk about how democracy is broken.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is critical because especially over the last 4 years, I think maybe some people have gotten the sense that the corruption and the conflicts of interest and the kinds of things that we've seen at the federal level are new, when in fact they're not. They're just sort of pushed to 11, you know, they're turned all the way up. But the fact of the matter is that before President Trump took office, we were already in a system where people with resources, companies with resources, had more of a voice in Washington and state houses around the country. If you have money, you have the ability to buy access to the most powerful people in the country. And to be clear, I'm not saying buy bills. I'm not saying you go and you say, you know, I'm giving you $500,000, $1 million. I want you to write this bill and pass it. What it is when you have those kinds of resources, you get to go to the most intimate fundraisers, events. You get to mingle, make personal connections with senators, members of Congress, the president himself, his cabinet members. And so that existed, that predates President Trump. We already have a system where less than 1% of the voting population in the United States gives a contribution of more than $200, much less $200,000 or $20 million. And the people giving the big money are the people whose calls are answered and who get to have FaceTime with these elected officials. And that actually goes to exactly what Aristotle was mentioning about systemic corruption, where you create this shifting, growing imbalance where regular Americans don't have access to the people that they have put in office. But the people who have enough money to pay them, either through campaign contributions or through super PAC contributions and things like that, do. And that's the problem. I mean, we as regular Americans can't hire high-paid lobbyists. We can't make $2 million super PAC contributions. We can't, you know, hire great lawyers to set up dark money groups for us to pour millions of dollars into. And that's the imbalance that we have. And that's the shifting sort of lack of representation that we see as a result of a post-Citizens United system where access to powerful people is doled out to those who have the resources to pay for it.
You know, Aristotle, you quoted Plato. You went back millennia. But I'm wondering, is anything more recent? The effects when they wrote the Constitution, you know, the miracle in Philadelphia thing back in the day, were they worried about this?
I think they were. I mean, I think that's why the First Amendment is the most important amendment. I mean, gives us the right to petition our government, gives a free press, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble peacefully. Now, all of those things depend on honest information you get from your government. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is painful to watch a process that and speaking to Robert's issue about the money, it has gone from retail politics that I came up through, where the spaghetti dinner in Tuscarawas County mattered, you know, the fish fry in Logan County mattered, the halushki dinner in Steubenville mattered. It has gone to this wholesale politics where all you need is a list of 5-10 lobbyists, and you don't need to get out to the districts anymore. So, I mean, the people have forgotten, and I would argue we, the people, have not deserted politics. Our leaders have deserted us, you know, by never, ever really, you know, it's hard work to be a leader. It's hard work, you know. I mean, the great factory bosses spend time on a factory floor. They didn't have an office, you know, 4,000 miles away. And I do want to get back to Jim Siegel, because he deserves so much credit. I mean, that guy, I think, the gentle giant that we knew him as. Legislators attended his memorial.
The governor was there.
Exactly. The governor was there. They spoke on behalf of the good work he did. You know, and he was just doing what the average, you know, homeowner, mill worker doesn't have time to do, and that's be at the state house. So the Jim Siegel Amendment makes sense. He was the last person to write an article about no more secret legislation. Now, before you all turn in tonight, I want you to go to a copy of the House Journal. I think it was January 7th, 2019. And I want you to read Larry Householder's speech, how he challenged the legislature on how they're going to use this state house that, you know, the people let them work in. What kind of tool, you know, wanted to open up the state house so people back in the districts know what we do every day. So I have said, I don't think it's going to be this hard to turn the lights on at LSC. If that was the challenge, if the people in Tuscarawas County and Mahoning County should know what's going on down here, the place to do that is the legislature. You know, Ann's been around as almost as long as me. They had night committee meetings.
I'm a spring chicken.
Well, not. I would have said almost. They had night committee meetings, yeah, because the people in Tuscarawas County couldn't get off of work
right
at yeah noon or 9 o'clock in the morning.
People would come and wait for hours to testify sometimes, yes, and they couldn't stay.
They would wait for hours. The local government committee, education, taxation, the committees that impacted those constituents every single day, the legislature gave them time. They went after session, you know, 4 o'clock or whatever, they go to dinner till 7 o'clock together. And David Brooks commented what, you know, anybody who's been around this business for a long time, the watering hole is a place of fellowship and friendship and congeniality where they could work things out. Now, if you're seen talking to the opposition of another party, your own party says, "What are you doing? What are you doing talking to Ann?"
Let's talk. Catherine, Common Cause has held a series of virtual events with the headline Blueprint for Democracy, How We Can Stop Being Ripped Off. What does, tell me what you're shooting for with these and what your proposals are.
So what became really clear to me with the Householder scandal was that House Bill 6 wasn't being repealed anytime soon. And that we were getting all of this drama about the scandal and, you know, what did Neil Clark say? But what we really needed was a plan for how we weren't going to let this happen again. How is it that we can stop consumers from being ripped off? And how can we make the state legislature more accountable to all of us Ohioans? And so we started to put together this Blueprint for Democracy. And we were looking at, like, well, how is it that you can create things that are more accountable and transparent? And I think there are a lot of really good ideas. But what we really did focus on was open government. So we talked about the Jim Siegel disclosure bill. So that notion that, like, we need to get good disclosure so that we can see what happens when they're making legislation. We can get access to those records. We also identified some disclosure when it comes to lobbying. You know, one of the things that is problematic is that, you know, we saw these ads from Generation Now, and they were very pointed about supporting House Bill 6, and it said Generation Now, but we didn't have any idea. You know, we had ideas, and we kind of knew, and we were able to connect the dots. But if, in fact, you know, they had said, or First Energy had to report that they had paid for them and that there was an association. So if we required lobbyists to say, oh, these are the other organizations that we are associated with, we would have better disclosure. We would just better understand what was going on with legislation.
And the point is that Citizens United, I just want to reiterate that issue, that just because they ruled on that in the way they did not foreclose state governments from enacting transparency
to this. Folks have started to think think it's somehow unconstitutional to require better disclosure,
right,
just because we never, our government didn't do anything about it. And so since they didn't require transparency, oh, well, it just must be the way it is.
That's just the way it has to be. I think a lot of people have felt that way.
It doesn't have to be this way. The legislature could require disclosure of the funders of all political advertisements, including corporations. Now, to do it right, you would have to, you know, let's say we make Americans for Apple Pie, and we decide that we're going to give Americans for Apple Pie, give to Americans for Cake, and then Americans for Cake runs the ad. Well, all they would be disclosing is Americans for Apple Pie, unless we got to the notion of the source of contribution. And so we need to be really clear that we don't just want, hey, where did you get that money for this ad, but where did it start from?
In October, Robert, you wrote about an $80 million dark money group with strong ties to Federalist Society co-chairman Leonard Leo. It's a close informal advisor to President Trump, who was deeply involved in all three of the president's Supreme Court nomination battles. Why is this is another aspect of all of this? It's not just about legislation, right?
Right. And so this is the problem when you start digging into dark money sort of a little further, is that you have this clear set of dark money groups that are engaged directly in elections. And that's sort of the clearest example of entities that are set up to shield donor disclosure and engage in large amounts of clearly political spending. But you have this other sort of outer ring of or maybe a gray area where massive amounts of money are flowing into groups. Like we mentioned ALEC, for example. Mm-hmm. There are other groups on both the left and the right that could sort of fall into this kind of realm where somebody is connected to incredibly wealthy donors. They pool money into a massive group with essentially no employees, no volunteers, operated out of a mailbox somewhere. And they use that firepower to establish policies or put people in positions that they want. And so Leonard Leo is kind of a prime example of this, where he's been tied to other massive dark money groups in the past that poured tens of millions of dollars into promoting, well, first blocking Merrick Garland's nomination, but then promoting Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and then Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation. And now, I should also say, Leo is also tied to a shell company called the BH Group, which gave $1 million to President Trump's inaugural committee. We still have no idea where that money came from.
And you called it a shell company.
Yes. It was formed in August of 2016. Within 4 months of that, so in December, it gave that $1 million contribution. It has no public-facing website. It has no clear offices. I went there. It's a virtual office in Arlington, Virginia. I went to the law firm where the only human being for a long time on the paperwork for that company appears to be a longtime paralegal at a law firm that does a lot of dark money work for Republican causes. And it's really not clear where that $1 million came from. But now with this new group and the other groups, there's still millions of dollars pouring into this. And so there's the question of dark money. There's the question of what are they trying to do with this money? Where's the money coming from? We know all of the donors gave more than, there's only three donors and they all gave more than $20 million. But then in addition to that, there's an angle of self-enrichment and profiteering that is also worrisome, because one of the things that is important for a nonprofit is that there's not excessive private benefit to the people who are running it. Uh-huh. Or that all of their operations are granting an excessive private benefit for a specific person or party. And so this group in and of itself just sort of checks all the boxes in terms of the kinds of things that people can get away with when they have the right representation and enough money. And we still have no idea where the money is coming from.
I want to take a quick call right now from Charles in London. Hi, Charles, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up this topic. But one of the things I want you guys, I wanted to ask questions about was judiciary, dark money in the judiciary. And during Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearing, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse did a great job of highlighting how dark money affects amicus briefs and different legislative or legal action initiatives. And I wanted to know if there's anything like that going on at the state level and at the municipality levels. Is your organization, the guy from D.C., I can't remember your name, sorry.
Yeah, Robert McGuire,
Do you know anything about the municipal courts and things like that, prosecutor's office? And thank you so much for taking a call.
You bet, Charles. Take care. All right, so is this something that, he referenced exactly what you were talking about, Robert. Is this something that can go on at the state level, Catherine Turser?
Well, yes, and all we have to do is look at the Ohio Supreme Court races where dark money has been spent, 20 years of dark money being spent. And they tried to figure out different ways to do it. And after Citizens United, it became completely legal. So the Chamber of Commerce's affiliate, which has gone by a bunch of different names, has been engaged in the Ohio Supreme Court races. I was really interested in the question about the municipal races and the AG races, those kinds of races that the local races. One of the things that we are seeing is more dark money in local races. And, I think the thing that's really important here is that we have now had 10 years since Citizens United, and clearly things weren't great before Citizens United. Really are living in a culture of corruption, and we need better, sunlight is the best disinfectant. We need to make sure that we do what we can so that we can get access to information and we can get it at the root of the problem.
We need to take a quick break. I'm sorry, Catherine. We need to take a quick break. We'll get right back to it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the political corruption invited by dark money and closed-door deals. Various reforms have been put forward to improve transparency and accountability at all levels of government. Still with us, Catherine Turser, Executive Director of Common Cause Ohio, at Robert McGuire, Research Director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, and Aristotle Huttress, former longtime Executive Director of the Ohio Retirement Study Council, former Chief Executive of the Ohio House of Representatives. He is consulting with Common Cause on its plan, it's a series of virtual events, the headline, Blueprint for Democracy, How We Can Stop Being Ripped Off. We'll have links to all of that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more. I know we're not going to get to everything. We're only scratching the surface of the surface of the surface. But I wanted to, you mentioned the Attorney General's office, Catherine Turser, earlier. That's another issue. I mean, there are so many levels. It's like an onion. There are so many levels where there's secrecy. And we don't even know why it's that way. There has been a lawsuit filed against Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost for records related to Republican Attorney General's group. What's that about, Catherine?
So one of the things that we do know is the Republican Attorney's General group does run ads promoting generally their favored candidates. And where does that money originally come from? That's important to know. I also think as we're thinking about like the kind of lack of disclosure, we also have the Public Utilities Commission.
Right.
Where, we know Sam Randazzo Sam Randazzo ended up resigning after the FBI raided his.
As the chairman of that group, yeah.
And First Energy and an SEC filing said they gave $4 million to somebody who regulated them. So, one of the things that we need is to get good access to, the records, Common Cause has been asking the commissioners to voluntarily disclose their business with utilities and consultants and lobbyists related to the utilities interest. I don't know that they will voluntarily do that type of disclosure, but we need to have robust disclosure so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again at the Public Utilities Commission. And then I also think we need to remember that the FBI came in and did the arrests and the FBI took action, but the Joint Legislative Ethics Commission, the Inspector General, you know, the kinds of mechanisms that Ohio has at the state level to address these things weren't doing the kinds of things that would be necessary to get information and stop things before they spun completely out of control.
You know, it's like we almost never hear about the Joint Legislative Ethics Commission anymore, Eris. We don't hear much about the Inspector General anymore. They used to be, it seems they used to be more robust.
Yes, that's correct. There are a lot of people missing in action. And I think that, you know, I think what was the Dispatch, they had a story on the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers.
Yeah.
You know, who offered the amendment, who wrote the bill, where did it come from? Now, you would think that as legislators, and I got a lot of respect for a lot of people, but you'd want to know. You'd want to know. I mean, you know, I mean, there are a lot of rules in the parliamentary procedure of the House, a lot of opportunities for people to get on a bill, to amend a bill. So I think, you know, when a bill passes and, you know, the clerk reads, add the name Huttress, add the name Fisher, I mean, you would think just as a practitioner, you would know what you're putting your name on, you know, so it's kind of frustrating to watch, you know, the process and not to have immediate disclosure of people giving money and immediate disclosure of who's helping write legislation is ridiculous. I mean, Amazon gets back to you in 4 seconds after you order something.
And it's that's a really good point.
Seriously. I mean, and you know, this, you know, the, and I think it was Suttis who wrote about
Tom Suttis, yeah.
The boss in the California legislature, Big Daddy Unruh, who said, money is the mother's milk of politics. Well, it's spoiled. It's like yogurt now. It is not. And no one suggested I shouldn't be able to give as much money as I want to somebody. No one is suggesting that I can't call a legislator and say, hey, I'd like to have a meeting with you if you could set it up with LSC. We just want to know. Justice Brandeis said, Catherine said it, you know, sunlight's the best disinfectant.
Right.
Centuries.
Let's see. Mike in Lancaster, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm just wondering, is most dark money tax deductible?
How does that work, Robert McGuire?
Most of the groups that we're talking about are tax exempt, meaning they themselves do not pay taxes, not tax deductible. They're not, so 501c3 groups, which are, you know, our group is, a lot of other nonprofits that you know of are 501c3s. They are tax deductible when you give a contribution to them. But a 501c4 is only tax exempt.
But hasn't so, that been a problem? They've been kind of mushing the lines between 501c3s and 501c4s, Catherine Terser. It's not clear if money's coming, you know, money. So maybe someone can donate money to a 501c3. Then that 501c3 could donate money to a 501c4.
I think one of the things that has happened, you know, you have a couple different things happening all at once. We talked about gerrymandering and
there's a lot
United, but at the same time as you're dealing with that, you also have the situation where the IRS is not doing the kind of investigations that they used to do of nonprofits.
Okay.
So the thing is, I spend my time worrying and making sure I mind my P's and my Q's. But certainly it's very clear, for example, that Generation Now, the nonprofit associated with former Speaker Householder, that had provided no public benefit. It's one of the things that is a real challenge right now.
And I know, Robert, I want to get you in here again, but is there any evidence that there aren't, if former House Speaker Larry Householder could do that, create Generation Now, are there other dark money groups formed by Ohio members of the Ohio General Assembly that we may not even know about? I mean, or do we know about them? Catherine?
So one of the things that I would say is that we do have rules of their, what I think we need to beef up, but like rules that are what are called anti-coordination rules, that our legislators are not supposed to be associated. Right. However, this would be a good example. P.G. Sittenfeld, I don't know if you had a chance to read all information related.
A member of the Cincinnati City Council has just been.
Yes. And one of the things that he said is that he had a dark money group. And so let's put it this way. If P.G. Sittenfeld, Cincinnati City Council, has a dark money group, it's very likely that all sorts of people have dark money groups at all levels of government.
And Robert McGuire, did you want to add something? We're running out of time, but I just wanted to make sure you get you in there.
I just wanted to say, Catherine, build off what Catherine said. It's a critical point to understand that there is a question of what is and isn't it possible for a dark money, for a 501c3 to group to do, like what is legal for them and what the IRS can actually do about it. It is constantly being gutted of its funding. And at its core, it's a revenue collection agency. And we're talking about groups that aren't paying taxes. And so the more its resources are cut, the more it's going to divert to revenue collection, to doing audits on individuals and companies, and not paying attention to what nonprofit groups are doing. And actually, one of the things that came out during the IRS scandal years ago, quote unquote scandal, was that the office, I believe it is actually in Cincinnati, where they review applications for exempt status, didn't actually even know what the rules were for engaging in political activity and things like that. It only audits something like 7 out of every 1,000 annual tax returns that come in. This is a critical part of all this, aside from sort of any discussion about what new rules and things could be put in place. The IRS itself is not equipped to go after these groups, both in terms of its training and in terms of its resources. It cannot cannot fight the best law firms in the country when they're trying to get tax exempt status for one of their groups.
And Aris, we've got 30 seconds, so go ahead.
To Robert's point, the folks who create this systemic corruption are playing chess and the rest of us are playing checkers. It's a starve the beast mentality that's gone back 20, 30 years. You know, if you don't want government, if you don't want us to know what's going on, cut the budgets of the people who are supposed to be watching the hen house. You know, so he's right. I mean, it's a bigger problem than just the Ohio State House or the New York Assembly. It's something that we all need to get our hands around. And citizen is the highest form of participation.
Well, we're not done with this topic, but at this point, I have to say thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. Robert McGuire, Research Director at Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. We'll have a link to their website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Robert, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And Aristotle Hutteris, thanks for your time as well. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
And Catherine Turser, Executive Director of Common Cause Ohio, thanks to you. Appreciate your time as usual.
Thank you so much.
Everybody else, thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.